I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more fun but informative, instructive, and even inspirational books of the season is Do It Wrong, How to Be a Poet in the 21st Century. Its author, Derek Beaulieu, joins me now to talk about the life of a poet, a writer, and an academic. You learn about the business of writing and publishing poetry, and if you make it past the harsh economics of it all, the book is replete with advice for the writer to keep on writing, to write as though nobody will read your stuff, to, as the title suggests, do it wrong. And as such, creativity and connection will follow. It's also a guide as to how to be a better reader. It's aspirational in that sense, but it also makes you want to be a better supporter of the authors and books that you like, but that also deserve to be talked about in our cultural zeitgeist. As an educator, Derek is a sort of teacher or mentor you'd have wanted for yourself. He's honest about the realities of the writing life, but also supportive of writers and tireless in building communities of writers wherever he goes. Derek Beaulieu is the author or editor of over 26 collections of poetry, prose, and criticism, including Silence, Lectures, and Writings, and Surface Tension. He is the director of literary arts at the Banff Center for Arts and Creativity. Visit derekbeaulieu.ca for more. This new book is published by Assembly Press. We spoke earlier this week with Derek joining me from Banff, Alberta. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Derek Beaulieu. Mr. Beaulieu, good morning.
Hi. Lovely to have a chance to chat with you.
Nice to talk to you as well. You know, I can't, as I said before we started, it's such a useful book, and not just for aspiring writers or writers already, but for someone like me who's a reader, it's marvelous insight into how writers work.
Well, thank you. I my intention with the book is to propose, is to suggest ways that writers and readers can approach literary arts, approach writing in a way that foregrounds discussion, foregrounds interaction. And, you know, I remember teaching students and interacting with authors here, and, you know, they worry about, is their audience big enough, or are they going to reach people, or are they going to sell? And I want to propose ways of looking at books as something different. This is actually a way of making connection, reaching out, and using art as a means of creating conversation.
And poetry, I found, is a marvelous way to have a conversation. Now, a bit of backstory. Growing up, I hated reading poetry, I hated studying poetry. A very good teacher told me, I think it was in high school or elementary school, and I can't remember, that song lyrics were poetry as well, so maybe that's an entry point, because we all listen to songs, we all know songs, right?
Yeah.
And only in doing this show, and I've done this show, the podcast now for 22 years, I've had to force myself to read poetry and fiction, things that I didn't really enjoy growing up. And I can't tell you, because I've had, you know, all sorts of writers on the show over the years, that the poets that come on with their books are the conversations I enjoy the most, because you can ask quite nearly about anything.
Well, I mean, I think your experience with poetry is not uncommon. I know certainly when I was growing up, and I did spend a few years as a high school teacher as well,
yeah. It
was not uncommon for me to hear my colleagues say things like, okay, so our next unit is our poetry unit, and have that tone of voice. I don't want to do it any more than you do.
Yeah.
But we have to study poetry, or we have to study Shakespeare, so let's all just grit our teeth and get through it. And poetry was often shown to students as something that was hermetic, that was sealed, that was top secret, and that you're reading it to, like, what does the poet really mean by this statement or that statement? And the student would read it and be like, well, these words all mean this, so I'm going to say that. And the teacher would look at them and say, no. And you're like, well, what the hell? That it shouldn't be something that chases people away. It should be something that greets people and welcomes people in. I think about, you know, so you have that model. But on the other side, when you go to an art gallery, when I go to an art gallery, and I'm particularly inspired by what I see on the wall, what I want to do is go home and paint. I want to, and this is why, you know, art gallery gift shops now are filled with, you know, crayons and notebooks and pencils and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because if it's done right, you want to go home and do this too. And I truly do believe that for a lot of poets, that's what got them in. They read a poem. They had somebody bring them a poem, and that blew their mind. And they were like, oh, this is not a hermetically sealed torture device. This is actually something fun and beautiful, and I want to do it too.
Yeah.
And that's where poetry can be, and I think it's where we want poetry to be, where I want poetry to be.
So as an educator, what do you do then about the expectations that we have about poetry? You know, you talked about, interpreting the thing right. You know, we worry about that because, you know, we're about to be graded on what we think the poem means, or if there's an essay due especially.
Yep.
Do you think poetry should be taught differently, and especially for younger people, because that's where it seems to be the challenge? I mean, you said it was an uncommon experience that I had growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I think that poetry can be taught differently. I think all of our classrooms need to be arranged differently. When I think about how we teach poetry, it's not about a series of decoding. This isn't trying to break a code or get into, like, as I said, what the poet really is trying to say. Read what's on the page. Read those words. Why are they in the spots where they are?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it arranged the way it is? Why are the poets choosing these words, not those words? How would you respond? What is he, like, what is he trying to say? What is being said? What is on that page? These words in this order, why? Because when you start to realize that every word you chose, every word that's on that page, that poet chose for a reason. This word, not that word. There are no accidents. So then everything that's there is there for a reason. Let's talk about it. Not that there's a right way of talking about it or a wrong way. Mm-hmm. What does it make you think? How would you respond if the answer was, you know, I think about Canadian poet Margaret Avison. In the 60s, she said that the best response to a poem is another poem.
Hmm.
And that to me in so many ways sums it all up. That any piece of artwork, whether it's a novel or a piece of music, it should inspire you to want to create in response, to be part of the conversation. The successful work invites you in. And I think it's up to our teachers, our classrooms, our universities to do precisely that this work is supposed to invite students in. And if it's pushing students away, we have a pedagogical problem, we have a material problem, we have perhaps a student problem too. But this is there to welcome us into another way of seeing the world.
Yeah, I found that in reading fiction, especially since I didn't like reading fiction as much growing up, mm-hmm. having to force myself over the years to read novels for you know, writers who come on the podcast.
Sure.
I've learned empathy a great deal from fiction, far more than I have in nonfiction. And empathy certainly in poetry as well, but it's a lot more work, I think. And over the years, I've enjoyed that work, sitting there. A poem is short or shorter than a novel, but sometimes you got to read these things two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get out of it what you need, as much as, you know, what the author meant even.
Yeah, and sometimes the poem is not about, you know, sometimes the poem is just about sound, or it's about a quick observation, or it's about how do these letters look next to each other, or it's a moment of play, or laughter, or, you know, an observation. And there are long poems, too, that, you know, the Iliad will sit next to any, you know, any novel, as would, you know, most of the work by Charles Olson will sit next to any novel. But this is work that has been really toiled over, as a novel would be. And I think that's, you know, when in the book I make a reference to my favorite poet, Barry Nichol, B.P. Nichol,
mm-hmm.
who said in 1985 that poetry is language raised to its highest power.
I love that line.
Yeah, and I love that. Language raised with higher power. Not language with the intent of creating riches and fame, but language with the intention and power to affect change. And it might just be a momentary change, that you just look out the window and you see something different for a moment. Great.
Yeah. You also give the advice to the writer in the book that they should write as if nobody's reading. And that's such a freeing thing, because I think, I'm sure you get writers all the time who worry about being a writer because of the at the end of the day, how much they'll make, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's, unfortunately, you know, capitalism does tend to eat everything. And so I think a lot of particularly younger writers, when they see stories of incredibly successful authors, whether that be Stephen King or J.K. Rowling or Rupi Kaur or whomever, they see this as an opportunity to make a living. But the number of poets in Canada who live solely off book sales, that's got to be, you know, less than a handful.
Yeah.
And so if you're doing it to make money, you're going into the wrong place. That the sales, the economics simply don't hold up. So then let that go. And it's very, very difficult because we are trained to want to provide for ourselves, of course. But try to let that go and actually write the way you wish somebody would. Write the book that 14-year-old you wished they could find in a bookstore that would just, like, that's the thing I've been waiting for, is for somebody to see the world this way or write about this thing that I'm passionate about. Do that. Because if you say that, like, you know, essentially, poetry sales in Canada are very, very low, and the odds of you making any money off it are slim. And, I mean, the reality is that you should expect to maybe make about $5 a week. So, $5 a week, one fancy coffee, if that. So then put that aside and write anything you want. You are free to make any, because it's not going to affect your sales. So, and in fact, it might do the reverse, because if you are writing from an incredibly authentic place of a book that you feel passionately needs to be written, you will find your audience. The people will be there. If nothing else, a fan letter, an email from a 15-year-old that's feeling lonely and unseen, whatever it might be, that's how you connect with the world. That's how poetry actually makes a difference, is that it looks around and says, there are people that need, I need this, and I cannot possibly be alone. Let's talk about it, as opposed to, I wish I had an extra $5 in my pocket.
Indeed, indeed. So how does it work practically for you in terms of your book buying? Do you pay attention to the sort of books that one should buy, say?
I don't necessarily look for, like, what books one should buy, but I joke that when I'm looking for books that do something I haven't seen before. I'm looking for things that challenge me, that surprise me, that present a point of view or a style of writing that I find, and this works for me, it doesn't work for everyone, that I find challenging or alienating, or as I read it, I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. I can't quite put my finger on the voice or whatever, because I'm here to learn, and I'm here to be in somebody else's position, you know? And if writers actually wrote in ways that were authentically themselves, I think that a tremendous amount of cultural learning could happen. So when I look around, you know, I'm sitting in my office, when I look around at these bookcases, it's filled with things that provoke. It's filled with books that when I look at it, when I open it up, I'm like, okay, I still don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to engage with this stuff, and that's a good thing. When I open it up and I'm like, okay, this is either I don't know what to do with it, or I can't figure out how they did it. You know, it's like a magic trick. You're like, I look at that and I'm like, I know that, you know, Queen of Hearts was in his right hand, but now it's not there anymore, and now it's, you know, inside that bottle on the shelf behind the person. How did he do that? And looking at books that the ones that really excite me are the ones where, like I said, it's a magic trick. I can't figure out how they did it, because that, you know, to extend the metaphor, makes me want to pick up a deck of cards and be like, did he do it this way? Did she try it that way? Did they, you know, bend the card? Like, how did they get there? this is learning. This is I don't know. This to me is the exciting part of writing.
So if you're like me, Derek, and you every month, every couple of weeks, you have the chance to go out and buy books.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work then? Do you because there's certain books that one has to buy in terms of, say, you want to read it because everyone else is reading it, or I'm sure there are poetry books that you buy because you want to support the genre itself.
Sure. I mean, there are poetry books that I buy because I just want to be, you know, a good citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But also, often, you know, if there's a book that I have deeply enjoyed, you know, as I write in the back of my book, I start at the back. And I read what books inspired that novelist or that poet. And they're going to say, you know, having read such and such, I'd like to thank so-and-so for writing this book, and it blew my mind. I'm like, okay, I got to read that. And that's where the conversation starts, because you start seeing how books come out of conversations with other books. And, you know, and there are ones that I always go back to. There are books that constantly, that feel evergreen, that constantly refresh me. And one of them, for me, one of the highlights is a book by John Cage called Diary, How to Improve the World, You Will Only Make Matters Worse. And it's his diary of thoughts as he, you know, traveled the world doing musical and theatrical performances. And it's, you know, a series of provocations, a series of statements and observations. And every time I read it, it inspires me. Every time I'm stuck, I don't know what to do, I pick up that book and just flip through it. Just idly thumb the pages, and something will assert itself. Something will come out, and you're like, oh, I could do that. It's the books that open doors. Those are the ones that I think are most precious for us.
So I read this book from the front to the back.
Great.
But I found that, it's been a couple weeks since I finished it. I mean, I could open it up anywhere and then find myself going back and rereading something and then finding something out, getting something out of it that I didn't get the first time even. And I think that's why this book is so useful, and I think will be useful for years to come for readers, is that there's something there that we'll all need, I guess.
Well, thank you. I that was the intention. I want to see this hopefully, you know, continue to inspire authors. I want to see this hopefully, you know, continue to suggest opportunities of how to write, how to interact, how to support each other, how to see writing as something different than what we're doing and as part of a larger conversation, but also change the way we understand art. I think all too often in the contemporary political climate, we see artists, writers as part of that, we see artists as, well, anytime a government is looking to cut the budget, they start with the arts first, and we've seen that happen in the Maritimes. And so arts is always seen as something that is fundamentally a luxury as opposed to a need. So it's often the first to go. It's the last to be funded and the first to be cut. And it was interesting because I just read a quote about the number of jobs in Canada that are in arts and culture. And there are 1.1 million jobs in Canada that are involved in the arts and culture industry. That is 200,000 more jobs than those involved with oil and gas. It is 700,000 more jobs that are involved in the automotive sector. Arts and culture puts more into the GDP, more into tax, and employs more people than either of those areas. This is, in fact, how we relate to the world, is through our arts and culture. This is how we relate to each other. And to see, if we continue to see art, to teach art, as you said, like to go back to that high school or junior high school classroom where, you know, well, I don't want to study poetry any more than you do. As long as we continue to see these things as a struggle, as a chore, as a nice to have, as something that can be cut, we're going to get what we deserve. We're going to continue to see art be underfunded, undersupported, underloved, when in fact, it's the driver. It's how we relate to each other. It's how we see the world. And I think that the world needs more of us finding ways to see each other, to interact with each other, and to support each other, now more than ever. So, yeah, ideally, this book can continue to push conversations forward and to suggest ideas of how to write that might challenge our expectations of what art is supposed to do in the first place.
As I read Do It Wrong, I noticed that you're a hell of a good mentor. I'm curious to know, who were some of the people that were helpful to you when you were younger?
Well, I did my I did 3 degrees at the University of Calgary, and poets that inspired me there that were I took a number of courses from Fred Waugh, the actually Canada's first parliamentary poet laureate and winner of the Governor General's Award, but also a ton of community members, a ton of really great folks that were there creating spaces and, you know, creating reading series. And that's continued. And I encountered the same thing doing my PhD in the UK under the tutelage of Peter Yeager, a Canadian poet who had lived there for decades. These are folks who, any writer who is seeing helping others as part of their own artistic practice, creating space, building reading series, making little magazines, tutoring, mentoring. These are the folks that I want to hang out with. The poet that has made the biggest difference in my life that I never had a chance to meet, he died when I was just a teenager, was, as I said, B.P. Nichol, Canadian poet Barry Phillip Nichol. And when I first encountered his work, I didn't know what to do. And I was like, I was resistant. And now I see a poet who spent a lifetime exploring concrete and visual poetry, sound poetry, comic books, opera, musicals, kids' books, fiction, nonfiction, and on, collaboration. And I realized that that's actually part of living, to me, living the writing life, is seeing this as a conversation that goes across genre, that goes across community, and that there is a joy in just, you know, helping each other. We're not in competition. We're in constant collaboration. That if another author does well, you've lost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You've only gained that your community is stronger, that somebody's had some success, and that ideally turns that garden over and keeps that that fertilizer moving towards other folks. And that's what the late B.P. Nichol did, is that a lifetime of supporting other writers, teaching, publishing, and creating work that brought him joy and challenged and provoked other writers to do the same. So while I never had a chance to meet him, I would say the most important writer in my life is the late B.P. Nichol.
And then the work itself, I mean, that's evergreen, isn't it? Because he's not creating anything new, but you can still go back and find new things all the time.
Absolutely. And many of his books fell out of print, so I had the pleasure of editing a book called Nights on Crow's Mountain, which was his collected fiction. And recently with St. Catharines-based poet and professor Gregory Betts, we collaborated on editing a book called Some Lines of Poetry from the Notebooks of B.P. Nichol, which came out in 2024, and is 80 selections from his notebooks from the 1980s in celebration of what would have been his 80th birthday. And that's a slim volume that came out of Coach House Books a couple years ago. So the work continues to provoke and excite and thrill me as a reader and others.
When you, because you didn't know the guy,
no.
when you see the notebooks and you see his writing and the way he writes, what strikes you about that? Does that do you see? I don't know, emulate is not the right word, because I mean you write the way you've written for a long time now. But, I mean, do you understand something by the penmanship, say?
Well, I mean, when I look at his notebooks, what strikes me is a continuous sense of exploration and play. That you can see him take an idea and roll it around in his mind, you know, or through his pen on the page. You know, this? Or maybe from this angle? Or how about this? Or what if this poem was a board game? What if this board game was an opera? What if this opera was a comic book? What if this was a visual poem? What if it was sculptural? And just like rolling these things around and then allowing the ideas to kind of spur out as you're spinning this thing, something spits out and you're like, oh, that would work. And it's that constant sense of exploration that you just allow your mind to keep asking questions, keep asking the what if. Don't go into it going, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Go into it saying, I don't know what I'm doing, and that's joyful and gleeful. And the surprise, when I write outside, as a poet, when I write outside of something like Do It Wrong, what I'm trying to do is have each book surprise me. I don't know what to do with this. But I'm hoping that that the readership will respond in a way that teaches me what to do with this and provokes me into figuring out what my next move is. So if this, what about that, creates these things. And it just constantly moves my own thinking and then the readership's thinking forward.
Can you quantify, Derek, how much better your own life is because you pursued a creative one?
I can't give it a number, but I can just say, you know, all the better. This is not an easy life.
Yeah.
But this is the life that I chose, that eventually, you know, it was kind of like I needed to surrender to and realize that, you know, no, I'm not going to be happy being a draftsman or working in another area. This is what I need to do. And once I realized that, like, no, this is what brings me joy. This is what I need to do. This is making space for other authors and teaching and mentoring and writing. That's what I want to do with my life. First of all, it was a huge relief to figure it out and just be like, okay, I'll just surrender into that and stop fighting it so hard. And that's why Do It Wrong is dedicated to my mom, is that she consistently said, well, you should be a teacher. And I was like, ah, and then finally it was like, you know, you're absolutely right. And you've been right from the beginning. So I can't quantify it in terms of like, you know, 76% better, but I can tell you that it's all better. This is the hardest job, but it's also the best job.
And that's what comes through in the book, and that's what makes, I guess, the spirit of the book so infectious, because we all want to lead better lives, I guess, but sometimes we have to do it wrong, and as the title says, because we'll find a way to that place that's better, I guess.
Well, I think that for a lot of folks, especially the folks that are drawn to the arts or creativity, or something that is maybe not part of the mainstream direction, there can be a lot of reasons culturally not to do a thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of roadblocks. There's going to be a lot of cultural expectation of like, no, if you do that, you'll never buy a house or whatever it might be. And those things are all either explicitly or implicitly teaching you to not be an artist, to not do it the way it needs to be done. And I think that that's, we need to remember to listen differently. You know, listen to other artists, listen to mentors, listen to, you know, teachers and props who are offering a direction, because the whole world is saying, you know, do it right, go in this direction. You know, just if you only made these choices, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
But I do think that we need more people and to do it wrong, do it the other way, do it backwards. And that's actually how we have the opportunity to live the lives that will make a difference to ourselves and our communities and our kids. Yeah, that's the way I want to live.
I've reached you in your office there in Banff. How many books have you got around you there?
Oh, it's got to be a couple thousand.
Yeah.
When I moved to Banff from Calgary a few years ago, we had to significantly downsize our library. But as I'm looking around this office, it's 5.5 bookcases in this room. And so everything's here. Mostly arranged alphabetical by author's last name, but every now and then there are exceptions to that rule. There's a big stack of oversized books at the bottom there that don't fit on any other shelf. All the Gertrude Stein books are together because they take up too much space otherwise. All the B.P. Nickel books are over there. And then, you know, all the books by Exact Change, a publisher from the States, are all in that pile over there because they're all exactly the same size, so they fit nicely together. And then there's, you know, little thematic piles here and there. There's a big stack. I just stood up and I'm walking across my office. There's a big stack of Dada and Surrealism. There's a stack of paperbacks about learning and social change. This, you know, it's mostly organized. I can find everything. And it's not too, and I don't think it's too full. I could probably squeeze in another few bookcases if I needed to. That'd be great.
That's a marvelous luxury to have, isn't it?
This is the first time I've ever had an office. So it's having the books out. This is like having my brain out. It's just a constant resource.
Yeah, like I'm desperate for wall space because then wall space affords me shelf space. And I think I've reached the max here in my office at home, which breaks my heart a little bit. And now I have to think about culling. And so what advice have you got as to how to cull one's book collection, say?
Oh, God. Painfully. I don't think there's any real way of doing it that doesn't ache. But I mean, in some ways, it's kind of like Marie Kondo. You know, keep the things that bring you joy, that inspire you, that push you forward, that you would love to see yourself read again and be rejuvenated again. And that doesn't mean that the books that don't do that are worthless. It just means that maybe it's time for them to inspire somebody else, that you've got what you needed from that particular engagement. And now maybe it's somebody else's time. And leave on the shelf the things that you're like, yeah, I'm not done talking to you. We have unfinished business.
By the way, Derek, this is somewhat of a personal question now. When we were all working from home, and I'm sure you were in your office on Zoom calls and the sort, did you do the performative thing of rearranging your bookshelves to show whoever you were talking to, whatever you wanted to show them, say?
No, unfortunately, I couldn't do that because during COVID, as an employee of the Banff Center, everybody worked from home.
I see.
But my bookcases are all at my office.
Mm.
So I could see my office window from my bedroom window, but I could not enter it, which means all the books that I had in my office, I couldn't touch.
Yeah.
And for you know, the duration of COVID. So, no, I couldn't do that. Mostly I sat at the kitchen table, or in my daughter's bedroom to do work and Zoom calls and that kind of thing.
But I'm sure you found it fascinating looking at other people's bookshelves, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's always rewarding. You get a very particular insight into who a person is by what their bookcases are like, how they're arranged, which titles are next to which, and how they decide to show them, you know, if they are hidden away, if they're put out front, if they're, you know, stacked mostly on the back of the toilet, whatever it might be. You learn something about readers. You learn something about people when you see what they read, if they read, and how they choose to interact with a book. There are folks that, you know, are very happy to dog-ear their pages.
Yeah.
And then there are folks that are very happy that you don't touch their books. Thank you very much. And I think we can all find ourselves on the spectrum of that somewhere.
How are you on lending books?
I would like to be better at it.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to lend books to people who I know I'll get the books back from. Yeah. But what I try to do to temper that is, if there's a book that I know I'm going to want to loan this out, other people need to read it, I'll get extra copies.
Yeah, well, like,
I'll scour used bookstores and find as many copies as I can and just keep them around so that when somebody's around, it's like, you have that? I'm like, I do, and I have an extra one. Would you like to borrow the extra?
Yeah, see, someone listening to this will think we're crazy for buying extra copies of a book we already have, but it's much better than losing the one copy that, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you never know. Like, sometimes, you know, you might have worn it out or whatever, so you need an extra copy or you need the hardcover or whatever to just keep that space, as I say, keep that conversation fresh on your bookcase. But having an extra, and one of the things I do here at work is that the writers' studios at the Banff Center all have little free libraries in them, so we keep extra copies of books around for authors to be inspired by.
Well, I found a great deal of inspiration in Do It Wrong. That and I got my copy for free from your publisher, so I'm going to buy two copies to give to writers that I think will find just as useful. So,
well, I'm totally honored. Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book and talking to you today, Derek. All the best and continue good luck with the book.
Well, thank you very much for taking some time to chat.
The website for more is at derekbolio.ca. The book is called Do It Wrong, How to Be a Poet in the 21st Century. It's published by Assembly Press. Its author, Derek Bolio, joined me on the line from Banff, Alberta, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.